Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Here we are in Connecting Faith once again. Good to have you listening. I'm Neil Stavem, and Ted Ross at the controls, and Chris is at the phones, and we're looking forward to a good hour today. In fact, in a little bit, we're going to connect with David Nasser, who you may have heard on Family Life Today. I think it was a couple weeks ago, and I became familiar with him a number of years ago and have been looking forward to talking with him for some time. So we're going to get connected with him soon, and that'll be great. Looking forward to hearing his story, an Iranian exile and former Muslim, and his life story. It's a gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But Ted, we got our fall fundraiser share coming up here in a couple weeks.
That's right. Yeah, actually, a week from next Tuesday we start, right?
Yeah, so a week and a half, I guess. Yeah, right? About 10 days away. So all right, we're excited about that. That is when we take care of the financial needs of our ministry. And, God takes care of it. We invite you to partner with us in doing that. And if you haven't heard that we are offering that, if you sign up here and join with us before September 9th, your name will be entered into a drawing for an Apple iPad. The iPad comes preloaded with a Bible app, the Faith Radio mobile app, devotionals, and other faith-based materials to help you connect faith to life every day. So you can visit myfaithradio.com for details on that.
Such a great deal. Somebody's very generous to donate that.
Yeah. And you don't have to be making a pledge or a gift to enter, but we certainly hope that you'll consider doing that. And thank you for your generosity ahead of time for being part of that. And we've got some great stories of listeners whose lives have been impacted because of the generosity of friends like you who have been giving in the past or maybe continue to give. So thank you for that. Yesterday, we had some time with Dave and Claudia Arp and talking about a book that was near to my heart. It's a $10 Great Date.
So, yeah. And,
why are you laughing, Ted?
I don't want to say cheapskate or anything like that. But
but it does kind of fit, doesn't it? So anyway, but they were talking about some of their favorites and things they do. And so I don't know, do you have a favorite inexpensive date, something that you do that doesn't cost a lot of money?
For us, just going out for a walk, that's free, and having time just to steal away even for a few minutes to do something like that. Have a budget and find a coupon and go out, sit on a patio somewhere, have a meal. Trying to schedule that with my wife, actually, for this weekend, so we'll see if it happens.
Oh, all right. So you're actually trying to have a date.
It's been a while for us, so it's on our calendar, on our radar, at least.
I like what David said, that dates are about, you talk about each other, and said if you have to talk about kids or, your accounts or anything else, then schedule a business meeting.
To get together and do that. Neil, there's a highlight I'd like to play if we could here. We have a little time of that conversation you had with the Arps yesterday. This is just a few minutes from the conversation that you had with Dave and Claudia Arp.
As the book, as you described, you've got the section, kind of the idea, then before you date, and then on your date, and then the talking points. Talk a little about the before. Is it something where you decide together, that you're planning it out, say, all right, we're going to do, here's where we're going to go, or is it just one of the spouses says, here's an idea for our date night? I guess you set aside a time first, and then just someone decides then what you're going to do?
Yeah, you could take turns. You don't have to do it together. You can do it together, but they're just, all the dates are really flexible, and you don't have to do them exactly like we line them up. But we give the idea that gives you the big picture, and then, one date that we like is the lobby hopping date.
We live here just outside of Washington, D.C.
And we got a lot of great hotels, and so the idea is you visit a upscale hotel lobby and just enjoy the sights and sounds. You watch the people come and go, and it's, you know, it's really fun. And if you want to be a little cheesy, you can actually just meet and flirt and pick each other up in the lobby. But beforehand, you know, one person would research what hotels are in the area and check online for, you know, you can see pictures of the lobbies, pick the more romantic ones, and then just, you know, whatever you need to do beforehand, and one person, you know, can do that, or you can do it together.
And usually the hotels are sort of bunched, so you can go from one lobby to another lobby.
Sure.
And what we sort of enjoy doing is you know, saying, going up and saying, you know, is the honeymoon suite available? You know, we'd like to.
Yeah,
you know,
we may want to come here on our 50th.
Yeah.
Sure.
Can we check it out? And it's sort of fun just to go up, you know, and see some of these really nice, I mean, really, some of these rooms are really incredible. And, you know, we'd never go there, but it's just sort of fun to think about it.
You know, how, do we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to say, well, if we're having a date, it's got to be special. It's got to be really meaningful.
You know, if you only have one date a year, that would be true.
Sure.
You know, if you're trying to have a weekly date, you know, it's just fun. You look forward to the time together. And this book definitely would not put pressure on them. And yeah. Instead, it would take the pressure away because it gives them the framework and, you know, even gives tips on their date. And then the talking points I especially like because it helps them to stay positive and it helps them not talk about work, their kids, their mother-in-law or whatever. And so, you know, it's just helps them to focus on each other.
Actually, that's a very good point. We, you know, these days are not to talk about your mother-in-law or talk about your finances or to talk about the kids. These are, you agree ahead of time, we're going to go out on a date, we're going to focus on us, and we're going to talk about the talking points and you know, not talk about these other. If you need to talk about those other things, then, you know, have a business meeting.
Sure.
Talk about those and then go out on your great date. But, Neil, one of our phrases that we use a lot is, fun in marriage is serious business.
I like that. He had Dave and Claudia had some good ideas. So I like the idea of the you know, going to the hotel lobbies, fancy hotel lobbies, yeah. Kind of looking around there. So.
That's great. And then asking to see the nice room up top.
Yeah. Hmm. So, yeah. Well, it reminded me of the joke. I said that, you know, I say I've taken my wife to some of the best restaurants in town, and someday I may take her inside. So that's,
yeah. Yeah, window shopping of sorts.
Yeah. So, and one of the other ones, I mean, they like going hiking, so I like doing that a lot. So, I don't know, do you have a favorite cheap, like doing the walk?
That's yeah, the walk thing, I mean, yeah. Maybe going down by a body of water of some kind around a lake. It's beautiful there down by a Mississippi River near where we are. So
they mentioned some of their friends do one where they take a movie on a laptop or some sort of device, and they'll go out to a park someplace by a lake or maybe even on a dock on a moonlit night and just watch the movie there. You know, blanket down, watch the movie there,
great.
Which is kind of interesting. Of course, if you could get by without the mosquitoes, that would be even better.
Sure, there's that too. Yeah, definitely. Well, it's good. I mean, it's good to hear that again and just be reminded that, you know, take that time, invest in that. And it doesn't always mean, I think for guys, we might think, oh, that means we're going to have to talk. Then we're going to get into the list. Set all that aside. That's the business meeting, as you
said. That's
so,
right. Yeah. So have a good date. Have a good time with your spouse and enjoy it. Maybe this weekend you can do that. We're going to take a short break and then come back and get to our topic for today. By the way, I was just going to mention, too, that if you have a great date idea, Dave and Claudia said they're always looking for good ideas. If you want to submit something to them, you can go to their website, 10greatdates.org, and then you can just click on the comments there, and you can submit your date idea to them, and they'll pick out a couple of winners and send you a copy of their book. So. All right, we're going to get to today's topic. We're going to talk about jumping through fires and more. It's an amazing story. You're going to hear a powerful testimony, and we're looking forward to meeting David Nasser in just a moment right here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. But Toby Mack, there's 14 after the hour. Toby writes in the back of David Nasser's story called Jumping Through Fires. He said, whether speaking or writing, David Nasser is quickly rising up as one of today's new relevant voices. This generation demands the real, and in his new book, Jumping Through Fires, David Brings the Heat. Of course, this has been out for a while, and Dave has written several others since that time. David Nasser is the founder of the David Nasser Outreach, and through broadcasts and TV and events, reaching hundreds of thousands of people annually with the gospel. Author of Glory Revealed and A Call to Die, and he lives with his wife and children in Alabama. And he was on not too long ago on Family Life Today, and I've been interested in hearing his story for some time. So I'm excited that David is with us today on Connecting Faith. Welcome to the broadcast, David.
Thank you so much for having me. What an honor. Love you. Great your show, and just great to be with you today.
Your story goes back to the late 70s in Iran, and I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize it a little bit for us. But I thought maybe in terms of an opening statement is that, you know, it does seem like all across the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and really much of, I suppose, the 1040 window, seems to be a lot of unrest. And you're not a stranger to revolution. It's been over 30 years ago. But take us through that maybe from the eyes of a child. You were, 9 years old when you snuck out of town, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. I was nine when the Iranian Revolution happened. In 1979, when the Ayatollah Khomeini and his religious zealots kind of overtook our government, when about a million people were massacred and killed, when what I like to call religion gone wrong happened in our country. My dad was high ranked in the military, and so in 1979, when the revolution happened and the government was overthrown, my dad's life was in grave danger. And so we as a family were forced to escape, not just because of my dad's life, but our entire life. I remember those days, Neil. I remember soldiers coming to my school and putting a gun at my forehead and telling me they were going to kill me because of who my dad was, only to have the principal beg them to stop. And I remember people coming to our house and dragging my father out of our house and taking him to a park where they were going to torture him to death. And just again, just by God's grace and mercy, was he spared that day. So we knew we had to get out. We knew we had a little bit of an open window, a limited amount of time to get out. And so we planned our escape and used my mom's heart issues that she'd had as an excuse to get some paperwork from some doctors. And we got two-way airline tickets like we were going and coming back. Well, we weren't coming back. We just ran for our lives. So, yeah, we are refugees. I mean, literally, we ran for refuge, you know, and we came to the United States under this thing called political asylum, which is just a fancy way of saying, you know, if we go back, we're dead. But, yeah, that's the beginnings of what I know as a revolution.
Wow.
Growing up. And when you're 9 years old, Neil, and you see a revolution go down like that and you lose your home, your family, you lose everything, and everybody tells you as a nine-year-old kid they're doing all of this in the name of God, in the name of religion, you end up hating religion. You know, and so most nine-year-olds don't think stuff like, I hate God. They think stuff like, I don't know, should I eat this crayon or whatever? But I was nine when I decided I hated God because I thought, if he hates me, you know, I'll hate him.
We want to pick up the story as you, you know, resettle in the U.S., but I'm just thinking that there are probably lots of nine-year-olds in your native land, you know, that are wondering today about, you know, where is God in the midst of all this? I mean, in all the unrest and the hate, these are dark days in many ways, aren't they?
They really are. It's interesting you just said that because you're so right. I mean, Neil, there are nine-year-olds and 90-year-olds, I think, all over the world, especially in that 1040 window, that are seeing, honestly, the destructive power of religion. And it's such a reminder for us that religion does not work. You know, the most, I like to say, the most messed up places in the world, you know, are the most religious places in the world, sadly, today. And so you look at the places where there is no separation in church and state. Church is state, meaning religion has taken over places like Afghanistan and places like that, and you just really see the destructive power of radical religion, you know, and it doesn't really change the state of someone's heart. It just tries to modify behavior, and it just always ends up doing more damage than good. And so I think there are a lot of 9-year-olds in Iran today who just think, wow, religion isn't working. And so is their 19-year-old brother thinks the same thing. And so does, you know, so does their grandpa at 90. And it's such a testament that Christianity is not religion, but it's a relationship and it's grace.
Was religion important to you and your family as a child? I mean, you were Muslim by culture, I guess, and birth. So was it something that you practiced religiously, I guess, quote unquote?
That's a good way to put it. Do we practice religion religiously? I like that. Man, honestly, we were never that devout, Neil. Like the most devout that my parents ever were as Muslims was the night I became a Christian. Instantly, they said, you can't be a Christian, we're Muslims. And I was like, we are? You know, we never really were until I became a Christian. And it was really more my father's pride. And, you know, he had lost his pedigree. He'd lost his place in the army. He'd lost his fortunes when he'd escaped from Iran. And now in his mind, because of his son converting to Christianity, they'd lost their religion as well. You know, their heritage more than anything. But yeah, we weren't super devout. We were Muslim by name, and we definitely, growing up, you know, I was taught the prayers and I was taught, you know, certain things. But the most devout I ever saw my parents was when I was 18 years old and do a testimony of just a really great missional church, I ended up becoming a Christian. And when I gave my life to Christ, my parents instantly knee-jerked and pushed back by saying, no, you can't be a Christian, we're Muslims.
I want to have you tell more of that story in a moment, but go back a minute first maybe and talk about what it means to be an exile, a refugee, and what parts are the most difficult? You moved from, as I understand, I think you had you been in the States before? Your father had done some training in the States militarily, right? So
he sure had.
Yeah.
My dad had taken flight training, like you were just alluding to, and he knew about America. They loved the United States because he'd come several different times just to get training to go back and be a helicopter pilot in Iran. But when the revolution happened, we knew that my dad instantly knew that if there was a place to go and begin again, there was no better place than the United States. I mean, it truly is, you know, the greatest nation in the world. It is a nation of second chances and new beginnings, you know. And so my mom and dad knew, like, no doubt about it, if we can get to America, that's where we want to, you know, start our lives. And so, yeah, the revolution happened and we escaped and we were stuck in Europe for about 9 months. And we tried legally, illegally, every way we could to make it to the States, and the doors just wouldn't open up for us until one day. My mom got us together as a family, and she said, hey, we want to go to America. Let's pray to America's God. She showed us a picture of a white man with a mullet and a beard. She said, this is Jesus. He's American. And so we didn't know any better. We just prayed to Jesus and asked him to let us into his country. And even though that's a pretty theologically incorrect prayer, God was bigger than our theology. You know, we prayed, and what I know now is that God was beginning his good work in us, because a week later, the doors opened up. And we were flying to America. When we came to America, you know, I was, a 10-year-old kid who came to America, you know, escaping religion. But in the back of my mind, I do remember thinking, I want to have nothing to do with religion, but thanks, Jesus, for letting us into your country. So that's my first memory of Jesus. And I think that's how God just used that little moment in my life to kind of put a wedge in this really hardened heart to say, you know what, don't think of Jesus as religion. And then, you know, we came to the States and kind of became that exile family. I mean, we came here in the middle of the hostage situation where 54 Americans were being held hostage in the American embassy in Iran, you know, in the midst of the revolution. And so we were from the wrong place at the wrong time. People were watching on TV how, you know, Iranians were burning the flag, the American flag, and calling America the great Satan, and, you know, beating the hostages. And so we were on the receiving end of all kinds of, just anger from people in America who were just seeing Iran treat their people very badly. And so here we'd moved in, you know. And so I was the outcasted kid. I was the kid who for years and years just was the exile. I came here, fish out of water, completely didn't blend in. Plus, I was from the wrong place. I was from Iran. And so I ate my lunch alone every day at the lunchroom table, never got invited to the parties. I know what it's like to go to the school as a new kid and not have any friends.
Well, David, you talk about in your story, talking with David Nasser and his stories told, as the subtitle says, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. And I recommend it to you. He's written several since that time. He's the founder of David Nasser Outreach and preaches and teaches all across the globe. And we're going to hear more about that as we go along. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, as a foreign-born, you know, student, I mean, you kind of were in that pretender role. I mean, I think that's pretty common, right? You know, what advice would you give others that maybe are in, you know, that are saying, I'm just trying to fake it, to fit in, and, you know, clearly I don't, you know, I don't have the right clothes or right language or any of that stuff. So what would you recommend?
Sure, absolutely. So just to back up a little bit and give a little context to what you were referring to, I was kind of the outcasted kid who didn't blend in. And then the day before my freshman year in high school, my dad felt sorry for me for being the outcasted kid and just took me to the mall and, for lack of better terms, gave me an extreme makeover. And so I went to school. I tell people I went from geek to chic, you know, from Abdul to Julio. I tell people. And man, I came to the American high school and found friends, honestly, because I just kind of conformed to the patterns of the world. I mean, I just became a kid who learned how to just show up at school and people will receive you a lot of times because of what you wear and, you know, who you end up at the lunchroom table by. And I was the outcasted kid for years. And then I learned during high school to play the opposite. I learned how to kind of become what everybody wanted me to become. And I learned how to end up at the right lunchroom table. And I learned how to dump the right girl before she could dump me and how to be cold to be perceived as cool. And I just played high school. And so many times people are just alone and insecure, and how that manifests itself is you end up, you know, putting on the dog and pony show just because you're just tired of being alone. And at least when I was a nobody, I was David Nasser, the nobody, but all I'd become is really just a kid who'd sold out. And it's so true, you know, where it says in Scripture, in the Bible, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world but to forfeit his soul? Because that's what I've done. I just completely sold my identity just in order to have friends, even when they're fabricated friends, you know. It still felt to me better than the loneliness that I was going through.
Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about some friends that befriended David, and they saw through, I mean, who he was trying to be and didn't give up on him. And we'll talk more about his story. We're reflecting on the story he's written in the book, Jumping Through Fires, the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. David Nasser, one of America's foremost evangelists now, speaks to hundreds of thousands of people each year. And he and his wife, Jennifer, and their couple of children live in Alabama. And we're going to get more of the story coming up in a moment. If you'd like to, maybe you've heard David's story before and just would like to react to it or join the conversation, you're always welcome to do that. It's 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. We'll talk a little bit more about some ways that perhaps we could have a greater impact and outreach to those refugees or maybe even those Muslims in our neighborhood, in our midst. And we're going to talk about how his family found their way to Jesus. Some amazing stories yet to come. So stay tuned for more here on Connecting Faith, talking with David Nasser today. It's 32 past the hour, and we're connecting today with David Nasser, founder of the David Nasser Outreach, and he is an evangelist, a speaker. He's spoken to thousands of people across the world, really, and was mentored by a pastor in Birmingham, Alabama. He's been blessed to be part of several crusades of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, and he's written a couple books. His story is told in the book Jumping Through Fires. It's the gripping story, one man's escape from revolution to redemption. Also, A Call to Die, Call to Grace, Glory Revealed, a couple other books. And he's just, we were just talking during the break, moved to a new position as a senior VP at Liberty University. So congratulations on, that's a change for you, right?
It really is. Thank you. It's a great opportunity for me to be a part of raising a new generation of leaders who want to be champions for Christ. And Liberty University is the largest Christian university in the world now, over 90,000 online, and then almost 14,000 here on campus at Liberty Mountain here in Lynchburg. And when Chancellor Falwell called and said, would you pray about coming and playing a pastoral role here? It was just an honor. And the more we prayed, the more we felt like God was releasing us as a family to come. So I am brand new here in the city. And so, it's exciting to be a part of that. But I'll still get to travel quite a bit and still get to speak and do great fun things like this show right here together.
Well, David, let's go back and pick up the story a little bit, because you're in high school and kind of out of high school. You ran into some guys who actually started caring about you and shared Jesus with you, and you weren't really interested because you were living kind of another life at the time. Pick up the story from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I was just this kid, Neil, that was pretty broken. I mean, I think a lot of times something is broken and you try to fix it and it ends up being even worse. And so here I was, this pretty insecure kid going through all kinds of issues, being the loner out of a revolution. And then the way that we try to fix that as a family was my dad just bought me a lot of clothes and got me a really cool car. And I just went the popular route with school. And a lot of people think that the way you solve loneliness is popularity, but honestly, there's just more brokenness. It's kind of, I call it, putting a cup of gasoline on a fire to try to put it out. It just does the opposite. And so I graduated from high school popular, but I graduated from high school suicidal and even more alone. And even more broken. And so I kind of went into depression after high school. And one day, a few months after high school, was out. I was in the car, to be really frank and honest, with a buddy of mine. And he and I were smoking some marijuana together. We just kind of passing a joint back and forth. And as we were passing the joint back and forth, I told him, I said, man, we've graduated from high school. All our buddies are gone. What are we going to do next? Where are we going to go be social next? And my buddy invited me to church. It was crazy because he was literally, handing me a joint while he's inviting me to church. But that is so Southern culture, And so my buddy said, hey, I've got an idea. You ought to come to church with me tomorrow. And I was surprised. I mean, he's handing me Mexican Red Bud while he's inviting me to church. And I know it says in the Bible in Genesis that God made the grass and it was good, but that's not what it means, right? And so, man, I said, really, you go to church? And he said, I don't ever miss church. I love church. And I told him, I said, I'm not going to church. And he said, why? And I said, because I've seen religion destroy my country. I want to have nothing to do with religion. And he said, oh, man, you've got it wrong. He goes, this is Christianity, And he told me all the reasons I needed to come to his Christian church, because this youth group, he told me, was so social and so fun. And I wasn't interested until he named the five prettiest girls from my high school. And when he got to the five and he said, hey, they all go to my church, I felt motivated to visit. Sure. So I am literally the product of what it's like for God to use, these different things that aren't even the main thing, you know, to bring someone to church. And so I'm a big advocate of doing a lot of little bitty things to be attractional as a church, because at the end of the day, no one ever comes to Christ because someone's got a really nice youth building. But man, if that's what it takes for someone to come into the context to hear the gospel, then man, that's fine. You know, I'm a product of, I went to the church for the wrong reason, but God was bigger than my reason. And when I got there, Neil, to that church, even though I went for the wrong reason, what I ran into were a lot of authentic Christians. I didn't run into a youth group. I like to call it a youth ministry instead. And there were these students from this church. And when they saw me coming, they were just like, wow, there's the kid who always parties at school. And there's the kid who always, you know, is drunk on a Saturday night. And so they saw me coming, and they just decided I was foreign missions come to town. Like, they didn't even need a passport to reach the 1040 window. I was showing up at their door. And so, man, they just started loving on me and my family, and they started visiting me and coming to my house and sharing the gospel with me. And for the next 8 weeks, these Christians from this youth ministry would come to my house on Monday night and talk to me about Jesus. And then they would come to my house on Sundays and on, you know, Wednesdays, and they would drag me to church. They would just put me in the car and drag me to church. And I say drag me to church, I acted like I didn't want to go, but honestly, I really wanted to go, because there was something very distinct, very different about these people, I remember thinking, that I'd never seen before. And what it was grace. They were gracious. They were graceful. And they had something that wasn't religious. You know, they had something that was actually contagious. It was actually very different. And so I went and to the church and heard the gospel for 8 weeks. And that was the beginning of it for me.
Was there a tipping point? You're talking about, you know, experiencing grace, and after, you know, determining that you want nothing to do with religion, suddenly you're exposed to these guys and gals with not everybody's perfect, but they understood that. So talk about maybe that turning point for you, and then how that spread to your family.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a turning point. That's a good way to put it. I wish you'd given me that before I wrote my book. I had a chapter called Turning Point. The turning point for me was not a sermon, even though I just want to go on record and say, man, that guy could preach, you know, the one that I heard for 8 weeks. The turning point wasn't the organ, you know, that they had at the church, even though they had an amazing organ, like instilled in marble walls, it's a beautiful sanctuary. The turning point wasn't the music cantata, even though they had an incredible music department. What I remember was that we would go to eat after church, and they would just buy my meal. I remember the generosity of the people. And one night, we were eating at the church. We were eating after church at this restaurant. And we got done eating. It was like a Shoney's or something. It wasn't anything fancy. But we were all piled in this car. They were about to give me a ride home. And we got in the car, and as we were backing out of the parking space, the waitress that had waited on us earlier that night, you know, just a few minutes before the restaurant, just startled me to death. I was in the back seat, and I remember she ran to the car and started banging on the window right by where I was sitting. And you know, they stopped the car. Everybody was kind of startled that the waitress had ran out to the parking lot to stop us, and they rolled the window down, and she yelled in the car. She said, hey, you guys need to get out of the car and check your pockets. She said, apparently somebody has way overpaid. She said, look, the bill was like $30 for everybody, and you guys paid like $130 or whatever. And she said, hey, obviously somebody accidentally put down the wrong amount of money. And the guy that was driving the car, Neil, turned around and looked at her and said, ma'am, that wasn't a mistake. And she said, what do you mean? And I remember sitting in this car in the parking lot of a Shoney's, and this guy looked at the waitress and said, hey, we realize it's Christmas time. We realize that you've worked really hard. You mentioned that you're working a double shift today because you're trying to get some Christmas money, you know, for gifts for your kids. And we just all on purpose emptied our pockets because we wanted to bless you. And this waitress at this restaurant, she just starts crying in the parking lot because they just blessed her with such, you know, just love and grace. And and generosity. And so she starts crying. And then the guy driving the car, the guy, his name was Larry, he looks at her and he says, "Hey, Mom, we're sorry." He goes, "You know, we'll come back next week." And she just yells out loud. Like, that was her natural reaction. As soon as he said, "We'll come back next week," she goes, "Well, make sure you get my table," you know. And and she starts crying. And I remember, like, the next thing you know, I started crying. And everybody in the car was crying. And as we were driving in the car, and we had left this lady in the parking lot just with money in her hand weeping, I remember just thinking, what is wrong with these people? And that was the turning point for me. You know, we had talked a lot of theology. I heard a lot of sermons. I had heard beautiful hymns. I had been impressed with a church that was built for the glory of God with a $1 million organ. But you know what I remember? I remember the way that these people lived out the gospel in front of that waitress. And, you know, they told me about grace, but I never understood grace, you know, undeserving love, until they treat, and that waitress, I remember she was a horrible waitress. So the last thing she did was a great tip, but they treat her to the opposite of what she deserved. And that's the night I understood the grace of God. And so the turning point for me was honestly watching believers be believable, watching Christians be Christ-like. And so, man, that was the 1-2 punch. I mean, within 2 weeks, I was leaning in on every conversation, and, you know, I became a Christian.
David Nasser, since that time, has gone on to speak to thousands, had opportunities to share at the Billy Graham evangelistic events, and was an assistant with evangelist Rick Stanley and Jay Strack, and has written several books, including A Call to Die, A Call to Grace, Glory Revealed, traveled with some contemporary Christian artists, of which you would all know well, and we'll talk a little about that and more in just a moment as we hear more from David Nasser, and talking about his book, the story that we've been referencing, told well in this wonderful book called Jumping Through Fires. It's the gripping story of one man's escape from revolution to redemption. More with David coming up in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. We've been hearing David Nasser's story, how he encountered it and embraced it, and went from revolution to redemption. Talking to David Nasser about his memoir, the book called Jumping Through Fires. David's founder, David Nasser Outreach, and has just moved to a new position here just the last few weeks as Senior Vice President at Liberty University. And he has written several books, including Called to Die, Called to Grace, and Glory Revealed. And David, I know that you had opportunity to be mentored by some really wonderful, gifted Christian evangelists and teachers and leaders. Talk a little bit about maybe that mentoring and how maybe the church can do a better job of discipling young adults today.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is my heart. As a matter of fact, that is why I just took this position at Liberty University, so that I could hopefully be able to begin to pay back a little bit of what God did in my life and putting mentors into my life. I'm now, you know, in my mid-40s, but when I was 18 years old, a brand new believer, I'm so grateful that men like Dr. Jay Strack stepped into my life and just took me under their wing and said, "Hey, you know what? Here's a young buck with a ton of fuzz on his antlers who has a lot of passion but not a lot of content. There's a lot of energy, there's a lot of giftings maybe, but not a lot of maturity. And we just want to help raise him up by getting him deep-rooted in Scripture, by giving him experiences and by making sure that he doesn't get a big head, but continues to stay humble, you know, as God elevates his opportunities, you know, to preach. And so I think the church honestly gets a bad rap for not doing that well. I think the church is really doing that in a good well, but I actually do think, well, we could get better. I don't think it's broken, but I think where the church could get even better, we could all improve, is to really be on the prowl for those who God has uniquely made and called into ministry, and to ask the first question right. Like, the first question is, okay, so you love drama, and God just saves you, and you want to further the kingdom of God, reveal the kingdom of God to people through drama. How do we help you do that? How do we equip you as a saint to do the work of ministry? Or, hey, you're a basketball player, and you want to leverage your incredible ability to take a basketball and do amazing things. How do we help you further, you know, God's cause, to bring out the renown of Jesus, you know, through your gifting? Or, hey, you're a preacher, you're a persuader. Hey, you're administrative, you know. And so I think the church would do well to ask that question of a 17-year-old, a 15-year-old, who senses that they want to leverage their life for the glory of God. They want to do ministry and mission with their life and their gifting. And then we can come along and say, how do we help you? And sometimes the way that we begin to really help someone like that is that we connect them with someone who's further up the mountain in that same field. And we put them in a mentorship, you know. It doesn't have to be so official. It can even be more unofficial. For me, it was never called mentorship. I was just an intern. By the way, intern was a fancy way of saying, like, I was Jay Strack's intern. But, Neil, basically I was his T-shirt salesman. I mean, I traveled around and set up boxes of T-shirts and his books, and I sat in the lobby at his events. And the beauty of that was, while I was doing that, he also gave me an opportunity to be around him, to be a fly on the wall in dinners that we would go and eat. And Dr. Strack, and an incredible pastor, would have a conversation, and I just didn't miss the opportunity to shut up and listen, you know. But I got insight. I got a window into the life of some incredible people. And I watched Jay Strack not only travel as a communicator, but I also watched him be a dad and a husband, and navigate through those waters of what's it like to miss a bunch of ball games, but yet have to make up for it as a father by making some other decisions, you know? And so I think we would do well as a church to find people that can give us and give access to the next generation and just raise them up by bringing almost like an apprenticeship more than anything else.
You have had access to a number of Christian recording artists, and in fact, that's maybe where we kind of first, or maybe I first became aware. You did some traveling for a while, I think, with Third Day, right? Tell us a little bit about those relationships and how that developed.
Yeah, man, that's kind of crazy. I was just humbled by the idea that the Lord would allow me to have an opportunity to pour into these guys, you know, these and women that are in some of these bands that today have just become the modern day psalmists for our generation. But the short of it is, a lot of us kind of cut our teeth in ministry together. And so when I was out doing eighth grade boys disciple now group with, you know, five guys in a house somewhere, you know, Chris Tomlin was leading worship for those five guys, and we were just all getting going in ministry. When I met Third Day, they were a bunch of broke guys living out of a van, you know, with a whole lot of vision and not a whole lot more, you know, and we all just kind of got going together. And so it's funny. I mean, yesterday I was talking to Mac, and he's coming to Liberty to lead worship for our 14,000 students at the largest convocation in the world. And we were laughing. We're like, how do we all end up here? How do I get a fancy title? How did you become the 6-time Grammy winning, you know, guy who sold millions of albums? And really the answer to that is nothing that we've done to deserve. It's just, I think, just faithfulness, you know, instead of, you know, God just calls us to be faithful, not famous. And I love men like Chris Tomlin and men like Mac Powell, who just have just been faithful to just do what they do, and God has just decided to shine a spotlight on them since their entire life is nothing more than to be a big spotlight shined on God, you know? And so, these artists, we end up at events together, you know, whether even early on in life or later on in life. I'm typically not the guy who shows up at an event with other speakers because I'm the speaker at the event. So I'm in the green room a lot with these artists. And when you show up a lot and you do a lot of meals together and a lot of events together, you end up pastoring these men because a lot of them, I understand what it's like for them to be a dad. I understand what it's like for them to live in a fishbowl. Many of them in a much greater sense than myself. And so the Lord just allowed me to be able to walk into their lives and be a pastor to some of these people. And they have a safe place with me where they can come and confide and I can walk through it with them. A lot of times, a lot of these men and these women in these Christian bands, their pastor doesn't understand their lifestyle. The pastor doesn't understand the calling for them to be a road warrior. And I think the Lord's just granted me some of that opportunity. And so that's kind of how some of that got going. And then eventually you start doing projects with some of these guys. And so, like, for example, the Third Day guys, and actually Mac in particular and I, did a project called Glory Revealed, but we did verbatim scripture music where Mac wrote the songs out of God's word. I wrote a book called Glory Revealed. We had a CD called Glory Revealed. And so we got to kind of co-labor in a more official sense as well. And just a handful of tours and stuff like that. But, man, at the end of the day, I'm just an Iranian redneck, man, who just loves God and loves these bands. And it's funny, I'm a big fan myself, you know, of these people as well. So I'm not just the guy pastoring them. I genuinely love Christian music and what it does for me in life.
We got about maybe 4 minutes or so left. And we don't have time to get to the story about you, meeting and marrying your lovely wife, Jennifer, but you sort of challenged her about not settling. And I'm wondering if maybe that you have a challenge for us listening today about not settling in their faith journey.
Man, I do a lot of interviews. Nobody ever gets that chapter out. That's great. Yeah, in the book, Jumping Through Fires, I talk about meeting my wife, and like you were saying, I mean, my wife, by the way, is the. It's funny. She was 18 when she became a Christian. I was 18 when I became a Christian. She got delivered out of religion. I got delivered out of religion. She was like Bible drill champion for a good Southern Baptist church. She was 16 when she was on the pastor search committee of her church. You know, like everybody else was 50. She was. I tell people, kiddingly, you know, the worst thing my wife did was read under a dim light, get that tag off the pillow you're not supposed to. My wife was good. I mean, she was about Amish, honestly. She was so good in her behavior. But my wife was 18 as the lead counselor. She was leading the counseling at a Christian event, at an evangelistic event. When she walked down the aisle, took off her counselor badge and told her youth pastor, I don't know the Lord. And so my wife was 18 and got delivered out of religion, and I was 18 and I got delivered out of religion. The funny thing is she got delivered out of a lot of self-righteousness. I got delivered out of a lot of unrighteousness. But God somehow kind of put us together, and we met at a camp. And when we met at a camp, she had a boyfriend. She's the only guy she'd ever dated. She'd been dating him for 4 years, and they're about to get hooked up and get married. And when I met her at a camp, you know, we just started to have a conversation, and I wasn't honing in on another brother's, you know, girlfriend. I wanted to know this godly woman that was at the camp. She was a counselor and I was a counselor. And, I asked her what her dreams and ambitions were for life. And she had pretty audacious things that she wanted to see God do. Funny thing enough is Keith Green's music had really pushed the envelope, you know, in her life, and had kind of reconfigured a lot of the safety nets, you know, in her life out. And so she wanted to do great things with her life for the glory of God. But yet the funny thing of that was she's marrying a guy who just wanted to, you know, get in traffic, go sit in a cubicle, have an everyday 9-to-5 job and just live it safe and be a Sunday school teacher. And nothing wrong with that at all. But she had pretty audacious dreams. And she said, you know, I feel like I'm going to marry this guy who's a good guy, but he doesn't really want to color outside the lines.
We're down to about 45 seconds here, David. So
yeah, and so So I tell him the story. I said, you know, I looked at her and said, look, you can do a whole lot better than me, but at least with me, we're going to double down on a lot of risk. And, man, that's what it took to get the girl. And so, yeah, my wife and I are living the risky dream right here, one weekend to Lynchburg, Virginia, at Liberty University.
Well, what a fun hour. Glad to connect with you and want to hear more of the story someplace down the road perhaps here. And we'll find out. Actually, we never got talking about what jumping through fires actually means, but maybe we'll have a little bonfire sometime. You can explain it to us. But, David, blessings to you, and thank you for your passion and your willingness to share the story. It's great to visit with you today.
Man, thanks for having me on. Thanks for all you do on the airwaves, just bringing hope and grace. And blessings to your amazing show, brother.